Right.
Let's do this like they do it on the TV show, shall we? Previously on Underwood and Flinch.
He was pulled from sleep by an angry, intermittent buzzing. He opened his eyes. The room was dark, but the light from his phone on the nightstand was glowing in his peripheral vision. The LED on the bedside alarm clock told him it was just after 2 a.m. The phone buzzed again, demanding his attention. He reached out and picked it up. Who the hell was calling him in the middle of the night? From the small screen, Lisa's face smiled at him, a picture he'd taken not long before he'd left Brighton. Guilt flooded him. He closed his eyes and fell back onto the pillows. The phone continued to vibrate insistently in his hand. He was amazed that she was still bothering to call him. He hadn't taken a call from her since he'd come out here. Once he'd decided to resurrect Underwood, the idea of speaking to Lisa in person had felt wrong, as if opening a direct line to her might somehow contaminate her with the evil of the world he now inhabited. Initially, his only replies to her voicemail messages had been brief texts. Then, as things with Underwood had grown increasingly dangerous, he'd continued to listen to them, but stopped replying. Eventually, he'd just stopped playing the messages altogether. But now, Underwood was dead. Lydia was dead, and the evil of this world had gone with them. He opened his eyes, seeing her again, smiling at him, and was just about to take the call when he stopped. What of himself? Wasn't he now part of the evil? Hadn't he embraced his role as Underwood's guardian at the end? Hadn't some part of him even relished it? It was a question he'd considered for a long time, lying in his cell in Malaga in between interrogations. Maybe he deserved to be in jail for what he'd done, or if not in jail, at least banished from the company of decent people like Lisa. The phone continued to throb in his hand. Damn it, no, he deserved to be happy just as anyone else did. He was done with Underwood and done with David Flinch. He could go back to being good old David Smith, English teacher, clean and sober and living in Hove with, assuming she would still have him, Lisa. Before his mind could argue, he pushed a receive button. Hello? At first, there was no reply, but he could hear the line was open. There was something in the silence at the other end, tiny sounds floating in the soft hiss, indefinable. It was like she was there, but had forgotten to speak. Lisa, are you there? A breath, close to the receiver, and then her voice, tremulous, unsteady.
David.
She sounded strange, kind of hoarse, congested, like maybe she had a cold.
David, is that you?
Yeah, Lisa, I'm sorry I haven't called.
David, you have to come home.
She interrupted, her voice suddenly desperate.
Now, please, hurry.
What? He sat up, the lingering effects of the beer neutralized by the desperation in her voice. Why? What is it? What's happened?
He says you have to come or...
Lisa, who are you talking about? Who says I have to come home?
There are men. They say if you don't come home now, they'll kill me.
Her voice broke into sobs, and he understood why she had sounded strange. She'd been crying. Whoever was with her had been there for some time. The realization brought both fury and a wave of nausea. She could have been calling him about this for days and he'd been ignoring her. Whatever was happening to her, he could have prevented it by just picking up his damn phone. Lisa, Lisa, who are these men? Have they hurt you?
Not much, but they say they will if you don't come home immediately.
Who are they?
I don't know.
Let me speak to them.
No, they won't speak to you on the phone. Just come, David, please, they...
She was cut off abruptly by a clattering sound. Lisa! David cried. Lisa! There was no reply, but over the line, he thought he heard someone breathing. Hello? He demanded. Who is this? No reply.
Who the fuck are you? Listen, don't hurt her, okay? I'm coming. I'm on my way, all right? Whatever you want, you're in charge. I get it. Just don't...
He stopped, thinking he'd heard the caller say something. He listened. Then the line went dead. Immediately, he selected Lisa's number and redialed. After a few rings, Lisa's voice, happy and bright, told him to leave a message. He hung up. For a few moments, he just sat there, numb with shock, trying to understand what had just happened, and the final thing he'd heard on the line still echoing in his mind. It hadn't been someone speaking. It had sounded more like someone sniggering. He looked again at the clock. It was now 2:15. He grabbed up his phone, leapt out of bed and ran downstairs to book himself on the first available flight to London next morning. He could be in Brighton by late morning. And when he got there, whoever it was having such a good time terrifying Lisa, they were going to die.
Underwood and Flinch, Underground, a novel written and read by Mike Bennett. This novel is intended for an adult audience. Episode 1. David flung himself onto the chair in front of the computer and quickly accessed a last-minute air travel website. There was a British Airways flight at 0700. He managed to get a seat, but when he was taken to the booking form and the cursor flashed at him from the box requesting his name, he hesitated. The name he'd given the police when they took him in at La Fantasia was David Smith, his legal name and the name on his passport. The police had released him, but since the investigation was still ongoing, they'd cautioned him not to leave the country in case he was wanted for further questioning.
Shit!
He ran back upstairs to the bedroom and went to the pile of clothes he'd discarded when he undressed for bed earlier. He went through the pockets of his jeans and pulled out his passport. One of the last things he'd had the wherewithal to do before the police came up onto the roof at La Fantasia was to call Ildefonso Hernandez, the family lawyer. He'd been looking down from the roof at the scene below and had noticed the hearse parked out in the alley near the blocked entrance to the car park. He and Underwood should have been driving away in it, but there it stood, with David's and Underwood's passports and Matthias Flinch's sword hidden in the back, the sword with Sergei's blood and David's fingerprints all over it. He knew he had to get it out of there, for once the cops got the full measure of what had happened at La Fantasia, they'd cordoned the whole area off and the hearse with it. So he'd called Ildefonso. The lawyer had been asleep, bleary and confused at being woken so early, but he came to full alertness as soon as David began firing the bare essentials of what had happened at him. David had concluded by telling him where the hearse was and about the spare key in the glove compartment. Then he'd hung up as the sound of urgent Spanish voices in the stairwell began to draw near. Hernandez had got right on it. He'd told him later, while David had been in the Malaga jail, how he'd called one of his sect contacts who lived locally and told him to get down there fast and drive the hearse away. The guy had driven over without even getting properly dressed. He just ran out in his shorts and dressing gown with a pair of untied shoes on his feet. It was his outfit, or lack of it, that had won the day for him. After he'd arrived, he'd run into the alleyway, found the hearse, and was just getting into the driver's seat when a policeman saw him and asked him what he was doing. He told the cop he lived in a building that backed onto the alley and had seen what was happening. He was an undertaker, and he wanted to get his car out of there before it became blocked in by police and other emergency vehicles. He had a funeral at midday, and his car was obviously an indispensable piece of kit. Thankfully, the cop had taken pity on him and had waved him out with a passa, passa. Ildefonso had handed David his passport in the car yesterday as they were driving back from Malaga. He'd also handed him another passport. David now pulled that second passport out of his jeans pocket and brushed his fingers over the golden Spanish coat of arms on the cover. He turned to the holder's page where his face looked back at him from beside the name, David Flinch. Ildefonso had smiled at his look of surprise.
"I had our forger make it for you when you officially accepted the position of guardian, but this is the first chance I've had to give it to you since you completed it. I think it's only fitting, after all, since you were born in Spain, and with that name, too."
He'd then also given him two Spanish ID cards, one in each name. Now David put the passport and ID card of David Smith in the drawer of the nightstand, then took the others downstairs to the computer, where he finished his flight reservation in the name of David Flinch, a man about whom the police knew absolutely nothing. Once the flight was booked, he ordered a taxi and then ran upstairs to pack a bag. Later that morning, David sat in the airside food hall of Malaga Airport, trying to eat breakfast. He'd unwisely chosen a cheese and ham bocadillo, a thin baguette sandwich made without butter. His mouth, parched by alcohol and cigarettes, was having a hard time finding enough saliva to chew it. He took a sip of his espresso, another unwise purchase. He should have bought something with a reasonable liquid content. He drank the last of the bitter liquid and finally managed to swallow the food in his mouth. Then he dropped the remains of the bocadillo onto his paper plate and pushed it away from him. He checked the departures board. His flight still hadn't been called, so he took out his phone and tried to call Lisa again. As it had on every other attempt he'd made since leaving the house, the call went straight to voicemail. Damn it! He brought his fist down on the table with enough force to cause the couple sitting at a nearby table to glance over. He raised a hand in apology and got up to buy himself a large Coke. He took a long drink, washing down the hard ball of food in his gullet, and then returned to his seat where he pulled out his phone again and selected Ildefonso Hernandez's mobile number. He didn't want to tell Ildefonso what was going on, for now at least. Whoever was holding Lisa wanted him. It was personal. Once he had a better understanding of who they were, then he might get in touch with the sect. But then again, and it made no sense, but he couldn't afford to rule anything out, it could even be the sect that he was up against. He pulled a piece of Serrano ham from his sandwich and chewed it thoughtfully as his mind again went over how he was going to tell the lawyer that he was leaving the country. Every way he worded it, it always came out bad. "Just go with the flow," he told himself. "It's got to be done, so just get it over with." He pressed the call button. Ildefonso picked up.
"Hola, David."
"Ildefonso, it's me," said David, needlessly. "Listen, something's come up, and I have to leave the country."
"What?"
I know. Bad idea, right? But look, it's beyond my control. I'll..."
"Are you insane, David? If the police want to speak to you and they find you've skipped the country, you know what they're going to do?"
I imagine they're going to..."
"They're going to put you right back on the list of suspects, most likely at the fucking top. All my work in getting you off will be undone, and you're going to be screwed, my friend. Screwed. You'll be a fucking fugitive. You understand?"
Yeah, I know, I'm sorry, but I can't help it. Trust me, if I could avoid it, I would. I'm not a complete fucking idiot, but it's like I say, it's beyond my control. Something's come up, something personal that can't wait. It's an emergency, really, but listen, don't worry, I'll be back in no time, hopefully within 24 hours.
Ildefonso launched into a torrent of rebuke, and David held the phone away from his head as he read on the departures board that his flight had now been called. He held the phone to his face and spoke over the tinny ferocity that continued to blast from it.
"Yeah, tomorrow, okay? I'll call you tomorrow."
He turned off his phone, pulled the last piece of Serrano ham from his bocadillo, and headed for his flight to London. David awoke to the rattle of unbuckling seatbelts and an announcement welcoming him to London's Gatwick Airport. His sleep had been fitful, his mind drifting between sleeping and waking nightmares all the way. He had the aisle seat, and the two passengers between him and the window were now half-standing with polite impatience, eager to join the frenzy of overhead locker-emptying going on in the aisle. David unbuckled his seatbelt and got up to let them out, before sitting down again. The window was streaked with rain. He shifted over to the window seat to look outside. Ground staff in fluorescent rain gear were moving around the plane. They looked pissed off. David then noticed that someone had left half a bottle of water in the webbed magazine holder on the back of the seat in front of him. His mouth tasted bitter and dry. He pulled the bottle out and drank the water down in one. Then he replaced the bottle and looked to where the other passengers had now set into a congealed mass of bodies awaiting the exit doors to open. A woman was looking down at him with an expression that was either concern or contempt. He couldn't decide. Then he realized she was the one who'd been sitting in the window seat. He looked at the empty bottle, then back at her.
"Sorry, did you want that?"
The woman looked away like he didn't exist. He smiled. Such indignation over nothing. He sat back in his seat, closed his eyes, and waited for the crowd to shuffle out. Having only a small backpack as hand baggage, David got through the airport quickly. He'd been nervous at passport control, but his new Spanish passport was waved through with no more than a cursory glance. He made his way through to the airport railway station and caught the Gatwick Express to Brighton. The journey lasted just over 30 minutes, and upon his arrival he felt a wave of relief at being home again. But it was fleeting, just a sense of gratitude for the familiar, nothing more. Outside the station the sky was bright blue, with only a few white clouds overhead. He went to the taxi rank and stepped into one of the waiting turquoise and white city cabs, telling the driver to take him to the Robert Dias hardware store on the Western Road, a short distance from his street. Once there, he paid off the driver and went into the shop. 5 minutes later, he emerged again, but now with a 13-centimetre bladed kitchen knife in a small carrier bag. He walked quickly down the Western Road to the turning of his street and looked around the corner. At the other end of the street was the seafront, Hove lawns and the sea, glittering in the morning sunshine, so bright that he had to shield his eyes against it. He looked down towards his building, some 200 yards away. There was no sign of anything out of the ordinary. He crossed over so that he was on the same side of the street as his building, limiting the chances that anyone watching for him from the window might see his approach. Then, keeping close to the houses, he made his way quickly down. As he grew nearer, he looked up to his window on the third floor. The curtains were drawn. Was someone peering out between them, looking down at him? He should assume they were, but there was no way he could conceal his approach. So he just strode on, keeping his head down and hoping they might not be overly familiar with his appearance. When he got to the front door, he unlocked it and stepped into the hallway. It was silent. He went to the foot of the stairs and looked straight up the stairwell, half expecting to see someone looking down at him. But there was no one. He slipped off his backpack and took the knife out of the bag. It was vacuum-sealed in plastic packaging that would normally need scissors to open. He bit a corner of the pack until he'd broken a small tear, then he twisted and pulled at it until it ripped enough for him to get to the blade and pull the knife free. He reached behind his back and lifted his jacket, then he sheathed the blade of the knife under his belt. He slid it out again, testing its draw, making sure nothing could snag it. Then, satisfied, he replaced it and began to ascend the stairs, taking them two at a time and making sure his steps landed close to the wall to reduce the chances of creaking. As he passed the door of the flat below his, he wondered about the guys inside. If the intruders had hurt Lisa, Might his neighbours have heard something and contacted the police? Obviously not, he reasoned, otherwise he wouldn't be in this situation. But that told him that the intruders had been quiet in whatever they'd been doing to Lisa. No obvious sounds of violence, no screaming. He began to climb the final flight of stairs up to his flat. His heart was pounding as the door rose into view. He put his backpack down beside the door, then slowly and silently inserted his key into the lock and turned it. He eased the door open. Inside, the hallway was dark. All the doors leading onto it were closed, and there was no light filtering in beneath them either. That meant that the curtains in all the rooms must also be closed. He paused, listening intently, searching the silence for the smallest murmur or sign of life. But besides the ticking of the kitchen wall clock, there was only silence. Very carefully, he closed the front door without a click. Then he crept forwards, forcing himself to breathe slowly and quietly, despite the hammering of his heart. He was about to open the bedroom door when he heard a slight sound from beyond the door opposite it. The living room. He froze. When no further sound came, he went to the living room door and pressed his ear to the wood. There was only the sound of distant seagulls out over the rooftops. David stepped back and reached for the knife, but then thought better of it. Leave the ace up the sleeve, he thought. If it was needed, he could get it quickly enough. He put his hand on the door handle. There was no point crashing in. For all he knew, they could be holding Lisa with a knife to her throat, so startling them was probably a bad idea. He took a deep breath and opened the door. The room was sunk in gloom, but he saw her immediately. She sat silhouetted against the curtained bay window, her head slumped forward and her hair hanging around her face. David could tell from her posture that her hands were tied behind her back. A short distance in front of her was the small dining table. There was something on it that he couldn't quite make out. He entered the room, glancing left and right and checking behind the door. From what he could see, they were alone. Lisa, he whispered. Lisa, are they still here? She stirred slightly, her head lolling as if she were trying to wake from under fathoms of sleep. He turned on the light, and the blood screamed at him. Her blouse, one of the white ones she wore for work in her part-time job at American Express, was soaked a deep crimson. The green rug beneath her chair seemed almost black with it, and on the cream-coloured curtains behind her, what looked like a single jet of arterial spray had dried to a rusty brown. Then he saw the thing on the table was a syringe. Oh, dear God! He ran around the table and fell to his knees before her, looking up into her face and gently smoothing back her hair. Her face was covered in dried blood, her eyes were closed, and her mouth was covered with a strip of silver duct tape. He peeled it away, and saliva spilled from her bloody lips. She drew a breath. Lisa! Oh, God, Lisa! He cupped her face in his hands and lifted it gently. Her eyelids fluttered, and she opened her eyes. David? Her voice was weak, barely a whisper. Then she tensed and looked around, her eyes terrified. It's okay. No one's going to hurt you anymore. I'm here now. Where are they? Are they still here? I don't think so. I haven't checked the whole flat, but if they were here, they would have come out by now. Lisa, Jesus, what did they do to you? David went behind her to untie her hands. They were thickly bound together at the wrists with duct tape and had been taped to the frame of the chair. He drew the knife from his belt and began carefully cutting the tape. They were waiting for me when I got home, hiding behind the door. One of them grabbed me, put his hand over my mouth. I thought it was robbery, rape. But no, they only wanted you. I tried not to tell them where you were, but they... Her breath caught as she started to cry. I couldn't...
Oh, Jesus, I'm sorry, Lisa. I'm so sorry. Christ, there's so much blood. What did they do to you? They... Oh, David, I had no choice.
Sobbing, Lisa brought her hands forward and covered her face.
They made me telephone you to tell you to come. They said they'd kill me.
He came back around to kneel in front of her, laying the knife to one side and reaching up to stroke her hair, comforting her, but at the same time examining her for injuries. So much blood. There was no sign of head trauma, nor were there any obvious cuts or tears in her blouse. Then he noticed that her hair was only bloodstained where it hung past her neck. He smoothed her hair away from the skin there. It was sticky with blood. But again, there were no cuts or injuries. Something was wrong here. With no obvious sign of injury, a thought occurred to him, though it made no sense. Could the blood have come from someone else?
Lisa, what did they do to you? Did they use a knife or something? Did they cut you?
Lisa looked up at him. Her cheeks were wet with tears.
No, they didn't cut me. But after the phone call, one of them, he bit me.
David felt the strength drain from him.
What? What did you say? He bit me, David. He bit my throat. I could feel his teeth breaking my skin. They were sharp, like knife points.
I pulled away, and blood sprayed from my neck. I was tied, gagged. I couldn't fight. I couldn't call for help. The one who bit me, he thought it was funny. He held my head with both hands, forcing me to be still. Then he lowered his mouth to the wound, and he started to drink.
David suddenly became aware of how cool her skin was.
Oh, no. Oh, God, no. I couldn't fight him, David. Couldn't resist. I lost consciousness, I think. And when I awoke, he was pulling my head back by the hair, forcing me to look up. Oh, I was so weak, like a rag doll. I've watched him bite his wrist, and then his blood began to spill from him, raining onto my face. I closed my eyes, tried to turn away, but I couldn't. The other man was behind me now, holding my head, and then the other one was pushing his wrist against my mouth, his wound trying to force my lips apart.
David felt tears coming to his eyes.
Oh, no. Lisa.
He fell away from her. She rose from her chair.
At first, I resisted. But the smell of the blood, it was different. Rich and sweet, intoxicating. I opened my mouth. I don't know why, but I wanted to. It was delicious. I drank, and immediately I could feel it making me strong again. Please.
David grabbed the table and used it to pull himself to his feet.
Lisa, sit down. You've lost a lot of blood. I'll need to call an ambulance. No, you don't, David. See, everything is all right now. No.
He shook his head, and tears spilled from his eyes.
It's not all right.
Lisa smiled, her voice happy now, reassuring.
What is it, the blood? Don't worry, it's not all mine. Some of it is his. Who?
David cried.
Who was this man? Who was it?
Who was it? His mind whispered mockingly.
Who else could it be?
It was impossible, but nonetheless.
He didn't say, but he knew you. Describe him.
She took a step towards him.
He fed me only just enough, he said. I wanted more, but he refused. He told me that when you came, you would make the pain stop.
I didn't understand what he meant, because there was no pain then. Not like there is now. This hunger, it hurts, David. But you can make it stop. I understand that now. Come to me.
David felt himself drawn to her, wanting to hold her, to let her take him, feed on him. He felt he would do anything to take the pain from her eyes. Her eyes, bluer than deepest heaven, calling to him. Then he forced himself to look away, shaking his head. No! Please, David. She touched his face, her fingers as cold and white as snow. David took her hand and gently closed it in his. With his eyes downcast, he said, Lisa, it might not be too late. I know what's happened to you. I think maybe I can help you.
Yes, you can help me. You can hold me.
She drew her hand from his and returned it to his face.
I've missed you so much, David. Won't you even look at me?
He felt his body rack with a sob, then another, and then he was crying.
I'm so sorry, Lisa.
Shh, she whispered. We can be together. He said that if I did to you as he has done to me, his pain would stop, and then we could be together again. But this time, forever, David. Don't you want that? You and I, forever and always.
Who did, Lisa?
He said, trying to move away from her, but blocked by the table.
Who said that? It doesn't matter, my love. All that matters is that you hold me and let me kiss you. It doesn't hurt, I promise. It's lovely. And then you will take away my pain.
She stroked his hair.
After all I've been through for you, all this, don't you owe me at least that? I do.
He felt her move closer to him, taking his head in both her hands, stroking his face. She exerted a gentle pressure, trying to raise his face to meet her eyes. David felt his muscles start to relax, to yield, because now he understood. He had lost, and Underwood had won. The vampire had somehow survived, and this was his revenge. David's dreadful punishment for failing him. So, let it happen. Let it finally be over. He let her turn his face to hers, though he kept his eyes downcast as she moved in to embrace him. He saw her lips part, her mouth opening wide, and she sighed, and her breath, like a draught from a slaughterhouse, was the stench of death.
No!
He cried, breaking her hold and shoving her away. She staggered, surprised, then screamed in fury and sprang at him, incredibly fast, arms outstretched. She seized him by the throat, sending him crashing against the table before both of them fell to the floor. Stunned, David barely had time to get his hands up before she was on top of him, pinning him with her weight and pushing his head back to expose his neck. David lashed out, striking the side of her head with the heel of his hand and grabbing a handful of her hair, which he yanked back savagely, breaking her hold on him. As he pulled her head back, he pushed his body up, twisting her to one side and off-balancing her. Then he rolled on top of her, struggling to pin her arms down, but she was incredibly strong. She pushed back against him, wrapping her legs around his thighs and seizing his wrists in her hands. He was caught. She opened her mouth, and he saw how her canine teeth had extended to sharp fangs. He strained to break her grip, but she held him fast, her nails cutting into his flesh. Then she began to draw her arms apart, slowly lowering his face down to hers. He saw where he was going, knew he couldn't break free. His only chance was to surprise her and get there faster than she anticipated. With a cry of despair, he snapped his head down as hard as he could and headbutted her in the centre of her face, smashing her nose and hearing it break. She screamed and hurled him aside. He rolled and scrambled across the floor toward the knife. As his hand closed around it, he saw the spill of sunlight on the floor at the base of the curtains. Sunlight.
"You bastard! You broke my fucking nose!"
David rolled over to face her, knife extended before him. She was getting to her feet, both hands clutching her face, blood dripping through her fingers. She looked up at him, but he averted his eyes.
"How could you?"
she asked, horrified.
"All I'm trying to do is keep us together." "Lisa, you're not thinking straight. You can't be. Don't you see what's happened to you? What you've become?"
She didn't reply. Instead, she gave a little gasp of surprise. Then she laughed.
"What? What's so fucking funny?" "Wait, I just need to..."
She manipulated her nose.
"There."
She lowered her hands, and he saw that her nose was as pretty and straight as it had ever been. She laughed.
"How is it? Not perfect, not yet. I can feel it still healing, but it's okay, yeah?" "No, it's not okay. Lisa, you're sick."
"Sick?" She pointed to her nose.
"You call this sick?" "Lisa, you're a fucking vampire."
"Oh, yes, thanks to you.
And now you don't even want to be with me anymore. You fight me, you break my nose, and now you hold a knife against me. You're trying to fucking kill me!"
He began to push himself away from her, the bloody rug sliding on the varnished floorboards as he inched closer to the window.
"I don't try to kill you, David. It is not death. Look at me. Am I dead?" "I don't know what you are, but you're not you anymore. You're not Lisa. Lisa would never want to hurt me." "I don't want to hurt you, David. How many times must I say? It doesn't hurt. All I want is for us to be together again."
She clutched a hand to her stomach.
"Oh my God, this hunger."
An idea occurred to David.
"Wait, I can help you. I could bleed a quantity, enough to stop the pain."
She was walking towards him.
"A quantity?"
She laughed.
"Oh no, 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 David, that is too mean. Too fucking mean."
She sprang at him, ignoring the knife and diving for his throat. David brought both hands together on the knife in the second before she fell onto it. Then, using the momentum of her dive, he lunged upwards, propelling her over his head towards the window. He heard her head strike the wooden panelling beneath the window, and for a moment the room was lit up by a flash of sunlight. And then she was screaming, and the room was aglow with a terrible incandescence. He rolled over to see her staggering away from the curtains, her head and shoulders ablaze. Her hands flailed in the air, beating at the flames and showering pieces of burning hair and scalp around her. David lunged for the curtains, catching the bottom of one and ripping it completely away from the rail. Sunlight flooded over him and into the room. He turned to see Lisa now completely engulfed by fire. She twisted and turned, blind in the inferno, colliding first with the table, then an overturned chair, before falling over it to tumble to the floor. She wasn't screaming anymore. She lay writhing, slow and feeble now, as the sunlight continued to burn her with a constant and ferocious intensity. David shrank back against the panelling beneath the window and watched as the fiery shape slowly raised a hand out to him. He put his hands over his face and closed his eyes against the heat
and the smoke and the horror. And then it was his turn to scream, over and over again. Welcome home, David. Welcome back to the nightmare you thought was all over, but in fact has only just begun. Join me next time, listeners, for episode 2 of Underwood and Flinch Underground. The music you're listening to is Ahmad Armour by Farid Farjad, courtesy of Taraneh Records, specialists in Persian music. Buy the track online at Amazon or iTunes, or go to taranehrecords.com. Sale links can be found at underwoodandflinch.com and mikebennettauthor.com. Other music on the podcast was by Andrew Rothman.
This podcast has been brought to you today by you. Yes, you. And all my other sponsors at Patreon. Thank you for supporting me, and never forget that everything I produce from now on, be it on paper or on podcast, is as a result of your contribution.
Yeah!
I did a mini fist pump there, but obviously you couldn't see it.